I think it's just going to get weirder and weirder and weirder, and finally it's going to be so weird that people are going to have to talk about how weird it is. Eventually people are going to say, what the hell is going on? It's not enough to say it's nuts. You have to explain why it's so nuts. The invention of artificial life, the cloning of human beings, possible contact with extraterrestrials. The systems which are in place to keep the world sane are utterly inadequate to the forces that have been unleashed.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today my guest is James Corbett. Be sure to check out my films. Doors of Perception is on Amazon Prime. Occult Louisiana is on Tubi, Roku Channel, Apple, and more. We are booking guests for December. If you have suggestions or you'd like to be a guest, email me, forbiddenknowledgenews@gmail.com. Today I want to welcome James Corbett. He is an author, journalist, and curator of The Corbett Report. James, welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much for coming on. Been looking forward to this. Today we're going to be discussing your documentary, Descent into Madness. I really enjoyed it. It does an amazing job outlining the ongoing gaslighting and psychological operations implemented by our own government against our own people. Freethinkers are quickly becoming the new invisible boogeyman and are being painted as domestic terrorists. And this documentary not only gives a great history of psychological operations against the people, but an analysis of the psychotic nature of our ruling class as well. I highly recommend everyone going check out the film. I'll have links in the description. There's a lot to get to with this, and we have a limited amount of time, and this is your first time on. First, tell the audience a little bit about yourself and let them know how they can find out more.
Sure. My name is James Corbett. I am a podcaster, which I didn't even think was going to be a profession when I started this, but here it is. So I started the podcast back in 2007. It's called The Corbett Report. And I've been doing that now for 18 years, and it is, yes, now my full-time job and profession, if you can believe it, and I scarcely can. I talk about politics and science and history and philosophy and psychology and whatever else tickles my fancy, and I've been doing that unreservedly and unabashedly for nearly two decades, which has gotten me canceled off of YouTube and other places at various points throughout this career. And the ride isn't over yet. So if people want to find out more about it, they can find my work at CorbettReport.com. Everything I do is for free, so I hope people use it as a resource.
Perfect. Your new documentary, Descent into Madness, what brought you to produce this particular film?
Well, as I say, I've been doing this research now for nearly two decades. And in that time, I've accrued quite a bit of knowledge about psychological operations, psychological warfare, various psychological experiments that have been done, and the results of those experiments and the kind of insight that they give, not only for would-be social engineers who want to engineer the population into believing this or that or disbelieving this or that, but also potentially the utility of such information for people like ourselves, people who presumably want to inform the public about the truth, about what's really happening in the world. Maybe there are insights that we can gain from these types of psychological experiments that tell us more about how the human mind operates and how we can best disseminate our information.
I thought maybe we could dissect a little bit of the information that you presented in the film, starting with the origins of this kind of psychological manipulation, starting with Soviet psychiatry. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. I start by citing that specifically because back in the early 1980s and in the 1970s and into the early 1980s, it was a talking point in the ongoing Cold War that look at them, they're Soviets, the darn commies. Look at what they do to their population. And they would point to the fact that there was basically made up illnesses, sluggish schizophrenia and other things that political dissidents within the Soviet Union were diagnosed with, which allowed them to be forcibly confined to mental institutions and forcibly drugged. And so there was, for example, as I cite in the documentary, there was a big write-up about this in the New York Times in the early 1980s, talking about Soviet psychiatry and the dangers of a system in which political dissent is made into some sort of pathological mental illness and what can be done to dissenters in such a system. And I point that out because, well, yes, I mean, I think that is right. The Soviets truly did employ that against their own citizens. But, as I go on to demonstrate, it's not that it was just the Soviets, and it wasn't just the Imperial Japanese government, or it wasn't just the Nazis in Germany, etc., etc. It's almost every government, at one point or another, has applied some of these principles against their own citizens. And so I start to cite examples of, say, even the American context, the American Psychological Association, and others who have found ways to pathologize political dissent.
And starting from the very beginning, the use of different types of drugs and entheogens was a huge and very important part of implementing some of these mind control programs and the psychological operations that even we see today, right?
Yes. And of course, the obvious and the most well-known example of that is, of course, the CIA's MKUltra program and the various sub-programs and other things that it was running under, and the Operation Midnight Climax and others, unknowingly dosing people with various substances, LSD and other things, in order to gauge their effects and potential usefulness as truth serums discombobulating agents, etc. So, again, there's been a great deal of study on that particular subject, and it does continue to this day because, as I point out, for example, just as one example, there's a psychologist, Martin Seligman, who did some pioneering work on the concept of learned helplessness and also on learned optimism, which people spend less time concentrating on. But for those who don't know, learned helplessness stems from experiments that I believe were originally performed in the 1950s, in which it was demonstrated that dogs could be made to essentially take and even accept electric shocks when they could easily escape them by a process of conditioning, a conditioning process by which they were first shocked in a way in which they could not escape the electrical shocks. They were harnessed in a way that they were forced to take these electrical shocks. And then eventually the harness was released and the barrier that was preventing them from jumping out of the electrified area was lowered, etc., to the point where eventually they would be easily able to escape the electric shocks. But they had been so thoroughly conditioned that there was nothing they could do to escape the shocks, that when they started getting shocked, they would just sit, lie down and take it. And that is a profound insight into psychology, not only of canines, but unfortunately of humans, that can be led into essentially accepting even incredibly horrible conditions that even potentially they could escape from, but they have been conditioned to expect that nothing they can do can actually change anything. And so there was this doctor, the psychologist, one of the people who was pioneering this field, Martin Seligman, who was researching about this and also about what could be done to overcome this learned optimism. And in his speeches, as he was talking, there happened to be, at one of his speeches, someone in the audience who was associated with the CIA and worked with them during their war of terror in the post-9/11 world on developing better ways of using torture against detainees. And he started to use some of those psychological insights, for example, to find out how to more effectively torture detainees. Effectively, in this case, of course, does not mean to actually get real, true information from those detainees, but simply to essentially get them to say whatever you want them to say, which was really the point of the CIA torture program there in the early 2000s. So that's another example of how this type of psychological research can be weaponized against us. Or we could take the other tack and start to recognize how those insights could be used to find out more about the world that we're in and how we can escape the shocks, so to speak.
Yeah, I definitely want to explore some solutions and how we can navigate all this. Before we do, I want to explore a bit more of the history of weaponized psychiatry. You were just mentioning some of the pioneers. Another one, Benjamin Rush, was essentially making up disorders to, as you say, pathologize dissent. talk a little bit about this man and his contributions.
Yes, to the extent that people encounter Benjamin Rush these days, they might hear him discussed as one of the founding fathers of psychology in the United States. He's officially recognized by the American Psychiatric Association as the father of American psychiatry. And so he is still well talked about in such circles, but certain aspects of what he talked about at the time are less remembered by history for reasons that should be obvious. For example, one of the illnesses that he came up with, essentially, was anarchia, which he defined as an excess for the passion for liberty, which could not be removed by reason, nor restrained by government, and threatened to render abortive the goodness of heaven to the United States. As in, oh, after the revolution, after the United States was founded, these people were still a bit uppity, and they still believed a little bit too much in this freedom and independence thing. Yeah, no, we fought the war for independence, and now we have this new government, so you should submit to the new government, is essentially what Benjamin Rush believed. And he started to enforce that through this pathologization of people, like, for example, in the Whiskey Rebellion and other things that we saw after the creation of the new U.S. federal government, that people were still a little bit too interested in this liberty thing. So we better tamp that down and pathologize that dissent. So he, for people that he characterized with various psychological diseases, he employed such techniques for breaking their spirits, essentially, as darkness, solitary confinement, and a special technique of forcing the patient to stand erect for 2 to 3 days at a time, poking them with sharp pointed nails to keep them from sleeping, which was a technique he had borrowed from a British technique for taming horses, which again should show some of the mentality of the people who are weaponizing these things. Again, whether it's the shocks against dogs or techniques for taming horses, essentially they are looking at ways to treat us like livestock or cattle or animals to be manipulated one way or another. And Benjamin Rush was no exception with that regard.
You also discuss a very important tool that was developed for weaponized psychiatry, essentially. That's the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which basically provided guidelines for diagnosis and was a major stepping stone for Big Pharma to start distributing their drugs.
Yes. So for people who do not know, the American Psychological Association, the APA, puts out their psychological Bible, the DSM, which a lot of countries around the world use as a basis for their own national programs for coming up with manuals for disorders. And essentially, this is, as you say, it's an attempt to create diagnostic tool for creating categories of mental illness, essentially. And the necessarily political nature of this is not a scientific document, this is a political document. And we can see that from the development of the DSM. As one of the guests that I talked to in this documentary, Dr. Bruce Levine, points out, back prior to the 1970s, the DSM had homosexuality listed as a mental disorder. And there were a lot of protests about that. There was a civil rights movement that was protesting against that. And eventually, of course, they did change that. And now homosexuality is not listed as a mental disorder. Whatever you think about that diagnosis, the point is that it is necessarily and inherently a political diagnosis. It will be put in or taken out depending on which way the political winds are blowing, rather than any fundamental change in the nature of human consciousness. And unfortunately, it doesn't just end there. There are many examples of that. I point, for example, to the oppositional defiant disorder, which was introduced, I believe, in DSM-4. They're now up on DSM-5, the fifth edition of this manual. But in that oppositional defiant disorder, essentially any child who is a little bit too questioning of authority or reticent to go along with authority, it can be diagnosed with ODD and, of course, drugged, which is generally the way that that psychology has developed, certainly in the American context. A lot of the answers to these psychological problems, which again, are more politically based than they are scientifically based, are treated with drugs and pharmaceuticals. And that leads to one of the big problems with the DSM when you start to look at the task forces that put together the various sections of the manual. For example, there's one on sleeping disorders or what have you. You start to find that the members of those various task forces, these scientists and researchers who compile this information and come up with these diagnostic labels, are themselves riddled with conflicts of interest, with most of these task forces consisting in the majority, some cases in the plurality or in the totality, of people who have connections or financial relations to the very pharmaceutical companies that then provide the drugs that supposedly cure these illnesses that they themselves are creating or diagnosing into existence. So that should, at the very least, I think, if anyone can pause for concern about how this process works and whether these labels... I'm not saying there is no such thing as mental illness or mental health, but I am saying that those categories are much less scientific than I think the public is led to believe.
You briefly mentioned MKUltra earlier. We all have heard essentially about the horrific experiments that people were subjected to. And I have to wonder how much of that is actively being implemented today as an ongoing operation. Essentially, that the experimentation was done to test the drugs that the kids are on these days. We can see how modern psychiatry was infiltrated to create a generation of the younger people that we are subjected to now.
Yes. So for people who don't know, well, I would say that the official line, of course, is that MKUltra ended. It is no longer an active program. And maybe that is true in the sense that there is no longer a program under that name that is currently running under the CIA. But one has to wonder about the truth of such a statement, especially given the fact that we know anything about MKUltra at all only happened essentially by fluke, by the fact that certain documents, all of the MKUltra documents were supposed to be destroyed. Certain ones managed to evade that destruction and were discovered. And from that, we learned about this program. And then there were the church committee hearings and other things that started to flesh out more information about them. We still probably only know a fraction of what was really going on behind the scenes there, with a lot of the documents having been destroyed. But anyway, what we do know is horrific enough. And to think that there... Yes, maybe that particular program under that particular designation may have wrapped up, but the idea that psychological operations are not being employed is, well, palpably and flatly untrue. And we can see that from, if nothing else, the recent commercials that the U.S. psychological operations forces have made for their psychological warfare campaigns. And I'm going to forget the name of the recent campaign that they had, but showing, you know, spooky images and having spooky sounds and other things, and making it sound as if it would be so cool. Wouldn't you like to be a psychological warrior manipulating the population? So the U.S. military even openly brags about it at this point. So those types of operations are still underway. And yes, with regard specifically to the drugging of children, the mass medication of children under the name of stopping these oppositional defiant disorder or whatever other pathologization of normal human behavior they come up with next, there's a number of things to be said about that. One is just the sheer numbers of it and the number of children that are now being medicated for those psychological conditions, again, should give anyone, I think, at least pause for concern. Because we've lived however many thousands of generations before this point without the use of such pharmaceuticals. But now suddenly there's a significant percentage of the population that just must have these pharmaceuticals in order to survive. Are we expected to believe that? But even it gets even worse, because as I talk about in one of my interviews with Dr. Bruce Levine, this wasn't in the documentary itself, but I do have other interviews with him in my archives at Corbett Report. We talk about the fact that although people have been led to believe, and still many people, I think, in the general public do believe, the chemical imbalance theory of psychological disorder, where, oh, you have a chemical imbalance, that's why you have depression or whatever it may be, so you take this medication and it will restore the right balance. The truth about that is that it was never really seriously believed by the medical profession. And at this point, it's actively disbelieved. No one who's an actual medical professional, researcher, clinical psychologist actually believes in the chemical imbalance theory. So that is a bunch of hogwash that is, but for some reason, everyone tends to believe it. And that is why a lot of people do take SSRIs or other types of psychologically active drugs, is because they believe they're restoring chemical balance to their brain. I also have in my archives, again, I didn't go into it in this documentary in detail, but I do have in my archives work on the connection between SSRIs and mass shooters. I mean, it just is a connection that there are a number of mass shooting events where the mass shooter was on SSRIs or was coming off of SSRIs at the point at which they started their mass shooting. There may be a number of reasons for that correlation, could be causational, but at any rate, there is a connection there.
Right, that's extremely concerning. Let's talk a little bit about the modern attempts to pathologize conspiracy theorists. They've had conspiracy hit pieces throughout modern history, people being called tinfoil hat-wearing conspiracy theorists, all the names that we've been called, all the gaslighting, and the severity seems to come and go. We seem to be in an era where it is back in full-fledged. We have censorship, domestic terrorism because of people's thoughts and free thinking and opinions, and there seems to be a flat-out attack on free thinkers right now. But this is something that has been seeded for a very long time, at least since the Kennedy assassination, when they coined the term conspiracy theorist, right?
More or less, yes. So for people who don't know, the document number is 1035-990. Please somebody fact check me on that. I'm going off the top of my head. But there is a CIA memo that was sent out during, in 19, I believe, 67. And it was sent out to CIA operatives around the world to give them an idea of how to respond to critics of the Warren Commission. And within that document, they do raise the concept of conspiracy. These conspiracy theorists like to do this, but we can counter them this way. The point is, yes, the word conspiracy theorist as a phrase was not uttered for the first time in the 1960s, but it was weaponized there in the 1960s. And from that point onward, we can see a sharp increase in the use of that term, conspiracy theorist, as a pejorative to put down people who are questioning the official government narrative on things like the JFK assassination. So it was clearly weaponized by the CIA, and it has been an incredibly effective weapon, because I don't know about your experience, but certainly my experience growing up in Canada throughout my life, certainly I heard anyone questioning various things referred to disparagingly as, oh, you're one of those tinfoil conspiracy weirdos. Yeah. And that is, of course, the image that has persisted. Given that, there has always been, I think, an underground of people who are resistant to that categorization, that label, who will continue to persist in such areas. And it has been, as you say, an ebb and a flow in terms of the conversation around it. I note, of course, the I Want to Believe poster right there behind you, which, of course, was part of the 1990s conspiracy culture, which was interestingly implanted by LA and Hollywood and Chris Carter. Yeah. And we could talk about the Lone Gunman spinoff pilot episode and 9/11 and all of that kind of stuff. But I would say we are perhaps going through another era like that, where conspiracy is becoming cool and I think being co-opted at the same time by mainstream forces that, yes, I certainly experienced it myself in the 2000s, 2010s, as I was talking about things like 9/11 truth, and of course being cast aside as some kind of conspiracy weirdo. I would say there's a lot more room for that type of discussion, even in more mainstream circles now, and we see relatively mainstream, high-profile people now openly talking about things like 9/11 truth. However, that does raise, in my mind, of course, the question of the extent to which this conversation is being steered, controlled, directed, etc., into safe areas versus actually dangerous areas. there is a lot to be said about that. But yes, there, the conspiracy theory term, at any rate, has been an incredibly powerful tool for controlling the discourse on a number of subjects.
You mentioned 9/11. Since that time period, that seems to be a very important turning point in the collective consciousness, how we viewed our government and corruption. 2020 was another one with the onset of the COVID operation. This is a huge one. It really started getting people looking at corruption and the nature of reality in different ways.
It certainly did. And it's an interesting, perhaps ironic point about the nature of false flag events or psychological operations that, yes, they can be obviously extremely effective, as 9/11 obviously and demonstrably was. There are at least a million dead Iraqis to speak to that fact, let alone all the other dead that have resulted from those lies. So, yes, unfortunately, it can be extremely effective. However, when there is such a spectacular event like that, it does certainly draw attention and start waking people up, as the phrase goes. And that is essentially the case with me. It was 9/11 Truth that got me researching in the independent media in the first place. It was the first thing that really started to send me tumbling down that rabbit hole. And I imagine, I'd like to imagine anyway, over the past 5 years, people who were caught up in the scamdemic and suddenly realizing, oh, hey, whoa, something really weird is going on here, probably started researching and finding out more. And now, as a result, I mean, who would have thought even a few years ago there'd be mass protest movements against the WHO, or people would be angry at, you know, Anthony Fauci or something. That would have been unthinkable a decade ago. It's thinkable now because of an event like that. So although these events can be very effective for the would-be controllers in forwarding their agenda in various ways, they also simultaneously can be very effective in waking a lot of people up and at least getting people more curious about what's really going on in the world around them. So it is a double-edged sword, one that I would like to bet that the social engineers probably take that calculus into calculation when they're deciding on what operation to do. Is it worth it to push this far, this fast, this hard, or should we ease off a bit? As, for example, we're seeing with the biosecurity state. A few years ago, the entire existence of the human civilization rested on you locking yourself in your home. But now, oh yeah, well, oh, there was some kind of COVID thing. Whatever, it's over. You don't have to worry about it. You got COVID, who cares?
Right. It's very interesting to see how the collective reacts and recovers from certain psychological operations. As far as people's reactions to this and the believability of some of these conspiracies, so many people will refuse to look at it and it will just remain some kooky conspiracy in their mind until they're actually affected by something. You cite a few stories of people who were arrested, who had their freedoms taken away. And this could be coming to our doorstep very soon, especially with the moves that have been made by this current administration as far as law enforcement, AI, the technological implementations to our government, things of this nature. But let's talk about some of the stories that you cite in the documentary, like Claire Sweeney's story.
Right. So it was over a decade ago. It was probably a decade and a half ago. I interviewed Claire Sweeney, who was a journalist in New Zealand, who in 2006, I don't remember the exact year at this point, but she was forcibly confined to a mental evaluation against her will and forced drugged for having dared to talk about 9/11 as an inside job. And there was a series of events that led to this, but eventually she ultimately got forcibly confined to medical detention against her will and against actually the actual laws of New Zealand, which specifically do not allow for anyone to be forcibly mentally confined for expressing a political opinion, which was exactly what she was doing. But at any rate, this is what happened. And as I point out in the documentary, that this happened at all is concerning enough. That it happened 5 years after the events of 9/11, that it happened in New Zealand, halfway around the world from the United States, is baffling. until we understand it in that general context of all political dissent can and will be pathologized by people who find it convenient to lock away people who are saying inconvenient truths and to force drug them. Another example that I go through, I briefly mentioned Dr. Meryl Nass, who is someone that I've talked to many times in the past, who had her medical license suspended by the Board of Licensure in Medicine in Maine for the temerity of suggesting alternative treatments for COVID. I also talk about Dr. Thomas Binder, who was talking about the craziness of the scamdemic and locking people away and all of these sorts of things, and who got then swarmed by 60 armed police officers showing up based on a tweet that he made that went viral, or a blog, I can't remember the exact post, but basically questioning the masking and what was going on and saying that there's no scientific validity to this. He was then accosted by 60 armed police officers with the anti-terrorism unit of Switzerland, who did take him in. He was actually diagnosed with corona insanity, which is not an actual diagnosis. That does not exist in any manual, DSM or otherwise. Wow. But that was his diagnosis, and then he was forced drugged as a result of that. So absolute craziness that doesn't make any sense unless we put it in that context of governments can, will, and are weaponizing the pathologization of dissent, trying to make dissent into a mental illness. And it is interesting, for example, in Dr. Binder's case, how that intersects with the anti-terrorism idea. So that the idea that domestic terrorism and these other terms that are being thrown around are being linked to mental illness. And of course, we have heard in the American political context for years now about the crazy woke leftist agenda and how that rhetoric is now being weaponized, and there have been various proposals at state levels and others to literally make wokeism some sort of mental disease that can then be pathologized and treated, which again, whatever side of whatever political aisle you claim to be on, I think we should all be concerned when the government starts taking into its own hands the power to label political dissenters as mentally ill and then start drugging
especially
them.
Because the pendulum always swings back the other way. And when we look at what's happening here in the United States with the new law enforcement AI infrastructure under the guise of protecting against the evil illegal aliens that are invading our country, what happens 4 years from now if the pendulum swings the other direction? Do we really think they're going to just get rid of all that infrastructure that is there right now to surveil the people and have complete control over everyone? I don't think so. I think they're going to utilize it for their benefit.
Unfortunately, I tend to concur with that. And hey, maybe that's only my supposition, but I think it's an informed supposition based on history and everything that we know. And it does play into that phenomenon that I've discussed on my program many times, that people are all too happy to support their person in power, having whatever power that he or she wants in order to implement the good agenda, the agenda that we know is good and right. And then 4 or 8 years or however many years down the road when the other team gets in power, oh my God, how did they get all these powers? It is a stupid and self-defeating game that people are playing because I think they are caught in a false paradigm in which they think they are voting for this or that team to win in this team sport. But the reality is, yes, maybe there are two teams on this playing field that are playing this game. But what you don't see is that, oh, these teams have owners, and the owners actually sit on a board and a league, and they're business partners, and they go camping and drinking together and whatever. They're friends behind the scenes. We never see that level of it. No, we're just caught up in the game that's on the field that we're taught is the entirety of the political universe. Yeah.
And from what I understand, there's some extremely concerning legislature and agendas coming out in Canada that have already begun to affect the citizens over there. I heard recently about the banning of guns almost completely. Is this right?
I will confess ignorance on this. I have seen some of the headlines on this. I have not looked into this story. It wouldn't surprise me. I believe there is some sort of gun whatever, buyback, confiscation, something that's going on. I would need to look into the details more. But unfortunately, as a Canadian who now lives in Japan, has lived here for over 20 years, but as a Canadian, I can attest that it is not surprising to me that enough of the Canadian public would go along with such schemes to make them viable, because the Canadian public, by and large, at least as in my experience, tends to be trusting of the government. The government is, yeah, sometimes it's incompetent, sometimes it fails, but generally it is well-meaning. And don't worry, in the end, it will keep you safe. And unfortunately, with that mentality, a lot of people can be led into the most draconian schemes because ultimately the politicians have our best interests in mind.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the psychotic nature of our rulers. Unfortunately, it seems that psychopaths tend to gravitate to those positions, and that is what we end up having to be subjected to because no one else wants those positions for some reason, and we end up with our global leaders essentially what you would call psychopaths, and this is measurable by their behavior, and you did a great job citing some documentation and studies that have been done that point out this very truth.
Yes, there has been a lot of research on the area of sociopathy and psychopathy. Having said that, even those terms themselves are somewhat open to debate, because what defines a sociopath versus a psychopath, or are they the same thing, or what? And there are different ways of defining and labeling these things. There are also different tests that can be used to actually diagnose someone with this diagnosis. And some people, even in my own audience, think that it is some sort of contradiction that this documentary talks about the ways that political diagnosis about ODD, etc., can be wielded as a weapon. And yet, but James, you're relying on diagnosis of psychopathy or what have you. I don't think of that as a contradiction. I do think that there are some measurable differences in the brain functioning of a certain percentage of the population. It's been estimated differently by different people in different times. For example, I talk about Andrew Lobachevsky, who was working initially doing his research behind the Iron Curtain in the old Soviet Union, managed to escape without all of his notes and documentation, but managed to recompile a lot of that. And he was talking about something, I believe it was on the order of 3-5% of the population being psychopaths. And again, there are variations in the definition of that, but essentially people who have no remorse, no conscience, no guilt, no sense of shame. It's a condition in which we use metaphors that are, because it's almost incomprehensible, I should say, for people who are not that way inclined to put their minds into that mindset. So we talk about them as reptilian or something. They you know, they're not human. Because for you and me, and presumably most of the people listening to our conversation, yes, you might stay up at night thinking about that stupid thing that you said to that person in, you know, seventh grade, and oh my God, why did I say that? Oh. Or having those moments where you think about things that you're remorseful for, regretful for, you have a sense of shame, etc. So it's impossible to imagine not having that. But if you were to imagine someone who did not have that, and who could slip on the mask of sanity, as it's been called, by emulating and preying on our sympathies and emotions and empathy that we have as normal functioning human beings, imagine how far you could progress up the ladder of power, because positions of power generally are obtained by people who are ruthless. If you are ruthless in the pursuit of power, you can generally accrue more power. And the thing, the inhibition that stops most people from ruthlessly stepping over their own grandma in order to, you know, become more powerful, is that we have a sense of shame and guilt and remorse, and we don't want to inflict pain on other people, et cetera, et cetera. But for people who are not burdened by that natural inbuilt moral safeguard, they are able to progress up the ladder. And that creates an incredibly important problem that I identify in the documentary, the problem of the creation of pathocracy. Because it is not just then that the psychopaths and cold-blooded killers, essentially, get into those positions of power, But then they start shaping and molding the institutions that they are controlling in their own image. Yeah. These institutions start to become psychopathic, so that people who want to make their way, even just go along to get along in the institution itself, or make their way up that ladder, if they are not themselves psychopathic, can become sociopathic. This is one way of defining sociopathy. Not that you are born literally with that brain function in which you cannot feel remorse or guilt or what have you, but that you start to adopt the psychopathic mindset and you start to function in a more psychopathic manner because you are placed in the environment in which that will be most conducive to your well-being. And we've seen this, for example, in things like the Abu Ghraib prison, torture, the absolute disgusting nature of what occurred there. It was just ordinary men and women from, Nebraska or Idaho or whatever, so getting shipped off to Iraq, and suddenly they're participating in these group torture and humiliation rituals and all of these things. How and why did this happen? Well, one way of looking at that is the sociopathic nature of people who are caught up in an institution, in a system in which they are being incentivized and making their way up the career ladder by being sadistic, by turning off their emotions. They will eventually start to do that, or at least some percentage of people will start to do that, and those people will then be promoted. So you start to develop this pathocracy in which there is this entire system which is being created by the most ruthless, the most sadistic, the most uncaring human beings that there are, because those are the ones who get to the positions of power. And that becomes an incredibly, as we can see around us, an incredibly overwhelming problem that starts to shape society itself.
Yeah.
Perhaps the entire culture around us in that psychopathic image.
Yeah, it has this trickle-down effect to even the normal everyday person that is trying to keep their job and following orders. We saw this during the COVID era with people ratting on their neighbors and calling the authorities for people who weren't wearing masks. Crazy stuff that was occurring. But there's also this aspect of glamorizing horrible behavior in humans. It's almost like things like pedophilia and murder is being normalized, in a sense, more and more with each decade that goes by. There seems to be a level of intentionality behind that as well.
Yes. Can you elaborate where you're going with that?
Well, if you look around where people's morality is, where the collective morality is compared to even 10 years ago, there seems to be this degradation, but it seems to be engineered in a way by, of course, Hollywood and what we're subjected to with social media, and the younger generations adopt this behavior more and more, and it just becomes more and more normalized. I mentioned the pedophilia being normalized. This is something that we have seen a lot through our entertainment industry and what's being portrayed on TV and especially in social media. This is something that's become obvious in my perspective. What are your thoughts?
I think you are right, and I think there's a number of things that are coming together to make this phenomenon, some of which may be organic, just as a result of the media landscape in which we find ourselves now. The nature of media itself has changed.
Am I still there? You froze up there for about 30 seconds. You're back now, though.
Okay, let me start that again. I would say that there is the media itself has changed over the course of the past few decades of the internet era, so that the old media oligopoly that controlled what we were seeing and hearing and reading on a daily basis, obviously that doesn't have the same control as it did before. Now more people are getting their information from online social media, which presumably, theoretically, is You and me and average people. Well, yes, well, okay, algorithmically highly manipulated, obviously, so that you will see what the big tech overlords want you to see on a daily basis if you are relying on those algorithms to serve you your news. But it creates a number of interesting effects, one of which is that, as people may or may not have had cause to notice over the past few decades, there is a difference between online discourse and real-world discourse. Yes. And online, you have flame wars, and you have trolls, and you have those types of phenomenon. People just going in, trying to stir things up and make a problem, etc., and laughing at the results, doing it for the lulz, and all of that type of behavior, which I think is a highly online manifestation of behavior. But since now we have a generation of digital natives growing up, having been steeped in that type of discourse their whole lives, perhaps even more so than the real world discourse they have with their friends, people are more and more embedded in their devices. I think they start to think of that as real discourse. That's how people really interact with each other. And then that starts to manifest in the real world. And so you start to have real world communication now not being like real world discourse where you talk to someone and try to understand their position, etc. Now it is like having flame wars and trolls and things in real life, and that becomes normalized because we all see it on the screen. So why don't we do it in real life? And so we start to see behaviors, I think, changing over the past couple of decades. And there are a lot of different ways that this happens. Some of them seem rather benign, like flash mobs. You know, that phenomenon that occurred, you know, a decade and a half ago, is people started to realize, oh, we can just get a bunch of people to all come together to, you know, dance and sing at this spot or whatever. Oh, isn't that a fun viral video? Yay. Yeah. However, of course, flash mobs can then be weaponized if one is so inclined to do so. And again, there are so many different aspects of this online behavior that's manifesting in the real world that can and presumably is being not only studied, but actively weaponized by the admitted social engineers, like the PSYOPs warriors in the U.S. military, who are literally bragging about manipulating human events.
This is something that I am constantly shocked by, the level of theatrics that we're subjected to on a daily basis through what we're seeing on television and social media. Basically, everything we're presented, in my perspective, has some level of manipulation, some level of theatrics, especially if it's coming from the news media on TV. It becomes very difficult to navigate what is real and what isn't. In your perspective, how much of what we're experiencing with politics and even high impact events, recent events, assassinations, how much of this is theatrics compared to organic events?
And where do you draw the line? Right. Because theatrics can play into organic events, and organic events can play into theatrics, and it can become a feedback cycle. So yes, it's a good question. Perhaps this goes to some of the questions that happen in the independent media space that we keep coming back to, about the extent to which this or that event was manipulated and controlled, or whether it was organic, etc. And to some extent, maybe sometimes that is actually decidable and we actually can come to a conclusion on that. Sometimes maybe we can't, we just don't have enough information to be able to sort out the difference. But sometimes maybe the difference isn't even the point, really, because the point isn't necessarily the event itself. The point is the reaction that that event provokes. And the reaction itself is real. Whether or not the event was fake or staged or manipulated or organic or whatever, the reaction can be quite real. Unfortunately, often, because the reaction can be, as we saw, for example, after the horrific events of 9/11, well, we better go bomb the hell out of Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria, whatever. Let's just get them all. As a result of, you know, a spectacular event like that. So yes, sorting out the theatrics from the organic, I mean, it's a good question, and sometimes in specific cases we can do that. But again, I think it's more the way that any event can be used to forward an agenda. And one example I like to give is, okay, so after 9/11, even just accepting the official explanation of that day, this horrific and terrible failure of intelligence. The intelligence agencies that are out there to keep you safe, oh, they failed. So, okay, let's just accept that narrative as is. So what are the two possibilities here? The one and the only one that was ever presented to us by the authorities, by political institutions, by the media was, oh, it failed because they didn't have enough money. They didn't have enough power. They didn't have enough data sharing between themselves. They didn't have enough ability to spy on you. They didn't have enough ability to round people up. So we need to give them more power and more control. They failed, so we better reward them. Was the only option that was ever presented to the public. Whereas, it seems to me perfectly logical that the other response to that would be, oh no, they failed us, so get rid of them. They're done. They do not deserve a second chance. No, a failure on that level? No, thank you. Again, even just accepting the official story as it is, we should have been presented with at least those two options, right? But for some reason, we only get the one option. So again, regardless of the event itself, it's the reaction that is the real point of events like that. And you better believe that they always have a reaction that will fall on their side of the agenda. So maybe we should be thinking about, well, what would be our side? What should we be pushing in the event of any event, real, staged, fake, manipulated, or otherwise?
Do you think the ideal end goal for the parasitic ruling class would just be essentially a lower population with the ability to completely surveil and control and possibly even predict crimes with artificial intelligence and have artificial intelligence be the base for governance?
Yes, I think all of that is unfortunately already starting to manifest. We are seeing the formation of algocracy, rule by algorithm, and people are being prepped for the idea that AI would make a much better governing system than having these silly, chimps in suits trying to make laws for us. No, we need a AI that will tell us what to do. And, Joe Rogan and others floating that very idea to the general public and a lot of people starting to think about it. So yes, clearly I think that is the direction in which we're heading. And if we are opposed to that, the question is then what is our alternative? What direction should we be heading in? My answer is always freedom's the answer. What's the question? I always think decentralization of control in every way possible is the way forward for us as free humanity, because we will sort out our problems better than the top-down system of authoritarian control ruled by AI bots programmed by big tech overlords ever will. And, I'm willing to put myself on the line for that one because I think that this is potentially the end of humanity. You talk about what the end goal might be. And yes, I think for a long time, the end goal has been to have that perfectly serviceable tax cattle population that can be farmed and fleeced as needed by the controllers. They are the working class that maybe makes the world run. But we control them. We fleece them as necessary. They're completely ours, and having digital ID tags in their ears or whatever, that's the system. But unfortunately, we're now even looking on the doorstep of the idea of having a genetically controlled or manipulated subspecies that would then be even more serviceable and compliant, or maybe even just eradication altogether. Maybe these tech overlords are high on their own supply and genuinely believe they're just going to upload their consciousness to the cloud and live as silicon bodies in the future, right. Utopia, transhuman utopia. I don't know. I personally don't believe it, but I think there might be people out there who genuinely do believe in that and are working towards it.
People hear this and information like this and they wonder, what can they do as an individual? Many may think the system, the parasitic ruling class, and the machine is too big to fail, and we've already gone too far. How can we fight against it? Let's offer some solutions. In my perspective, you can't play the game and win. You have to check out of as much as possible and not participate with the things that don't serve humanity. But what would you offer as some solutions to navigate the madness?
Well, here's a very simple, everyday kind of solution that doesn't seem like much on the individual level, but I really think could add up. I recently wrote about a trip that I took to Malaysia where I had this whole ordeal just trying to buy breakfast because there was a number of places that were cashless payment only, but all I had was cash. So I guess I can't pay with this paper money anymore? Oh, okay. Or places that had the QR code scanning system for their menu, but I don't have cell service here in Malaysia, so how am I going to use it? Are there any waiters? Can I actually flag a human being? Anyway, it was just an insight for me into how far along we are into this digital ID panopticon surveillance state and where we're going with it. And the again, this is not going to sound like a wonderful, amazing solution to people, but the solution that we have at our fingertips is at the very least, as this agenda starts to roll out and as more businesses start to play into this, do not patronize those businesses that are going into this agenda. Oh, you're cashless payment only? Well, goodbye. It was nice knowing you. And that is one of the things that I think was kind of the bright spot of this whole scamdemic, is that at the very least, it gave people a chance to see, for example, those businesses in their local area that wouldn't allow them into their store without donning the mask or taking the vaccine or what have you, versus those businesses that were happy to have you as a customer. Which business would you rather support? I mean, I get the idea, oh, we should be protesting because the supermarket won't let me in without the mask or whatever. But maybe that's a sign that you shouldn't be supporting that supermarket because you really want them to have your money. This is the point that I keep coming back to, is that the whole system, all of this, I mean, I know that the Wizard of Oz is sitting there, I am the great and powerful wizard and you cannot defeat me. And people start to internalize that, oh my God, it's so overwhelming, we'll never be able to defeat it, without realizing that we already have everything that we need because all of this is predicated on our participation, our literally our dollars or whatever it is that we're contributing, our time, our energy, our resources. We are building up this world and putting ourselves into this system of top-down technocratic control, whereas we could build up a world with each other. We could just support each other in this enterprise and start building up the community networks and ultimately expanding that into a real alternative to this system of control. I know it seems pie in the sky, and I know there will be people out there who say, well, no one in my area believes what I believe, or what have you, but I guarantee there's some pocket of resistance out there somewhere that you can start linking up with. There's some farmer's market or whatever it is that you can start using to start circumventing the systems of control. And it is like a muscle. You got to work it. You got to keep flexing it. You got to keep building it up. And it will get built bigger over time. And it's a slow process. And it won't always function flawlessly. But that's reality. And unless we get used to that, because I know people are waiting for the silver bullet, whatever, something from the sky that's going to magically solve everything. I'm sorry, I can't give that to you. All I can say is, yeah, if you work towards building up the world that you want, we already have the power. It's already ours. We just got to take it into our own hands.
Right on. James, thank you so much. This was great. Definitely going to have you back on in the future. Before I let you go, remind the audience how they can find all your content and more about you.
My name is James Corbett. I am at CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. I have 18 years of archives of audio, visual, and textual material. It's all there for free, so I hope people will use it as a resource. If you're interested in the Descent into Madness documentary in particular, you can go there directly, CorbettReport.com/madness, and you get the entire documentary, an entire hyperlinked transcript, audio download. However you want to imbibe it, I hope you do. And again, the hyperlink transcript has links to all of the source documents, absolutely everything that I talk about and cite in the entire documentary, so you can go and start researching it for yourself. If you are so inclined and you want to get even further into the question of psychology and weaponization of psychology, etc., I have an online course at my opensourceeducation.online website. That's opensourceeducation.online. I have an entire psychology course, which consists of several podcasts and videos and interviews and articles that I've done over the years on this subject, if you want to start exploring more.
Excellent. James, thank you so much. Like I said, we'll be doing this again in the future. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow. We'll see you then.